Hey, this is Riley Breckenridge from Thrice and Less Art, and you are listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
I am being realistic.
As the story grows.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
Live, Riley. How are you?
Sweet. I'm good. How are you?
Let's get this out of the way. Are you a Dodgers fan?
No, not really.
I see the LA hat.
Yeah. It was the hat choice today. I needed a black hat.
I want to know why you think the Dodgers are obsessed with all of the 2008 World Series Phillies. Is there a particular reason why they're all going out there?
Because Chase Utley is still great somehow. And I don't know how that works.
Yeah, well,
he's like as old as I am, and he's good.
We couldn't figure out how to make that work beyond 2009, 10-ish out here in Philly. Breaking my heart, man.
No, I mean, there's a huge divide where, I guess, in Southern California, people are like, you're either an Angels fan or a Dodgers fan. Mm. And my father was raised a Dodgers fan because he lived in L.A.
Okay.
And so we would listen to Vin Scully on the radio or TV when I was growing up.
Right.
But the Angels were 10 minutes down the road.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we'd go see Angels games, but then we'd come home and we'd watch Dodgers games. And apparently he didn't get the memo that you're not supposed to like both. But I grew up watching both. So now I follow both. And as I've gotten older, I really don't root for laundry anymore. I root for guys who I like to watch. So like, right. I'll watch Mark Trumbo play for the Orioles. I'll watch Carlos Correa play for the Astros, Bryce Harper, Jose Fernandez, Giancarlo Stanton. Like, I just like watching good baseball. It doesn't really matter what uniform they're in.
Exactly.
But
there's a reason why every channel switches over to the game if it's a no-hitter going into the eighth.
Yeah.
I just want to see a good game.
I love watching the Cubs this year because they're amazing. But should I not watch them because they're not my favorite team?
No.
I don't think so. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at now. Like, I just – if I have a chance to watch baseball, I don't watch a lot anymore because I have a kid. But if I have a chance to watch baseball, I'm going to watch – the players that I want to watch. I'm not going to necessarily just watch an Angels game because that's a totally insufferable project at this point. Terrible, aside from Mike Trout. But
well, being a Phillies fan and then the last place Braves roll into town and sweep them.
Dark days, my friend. Dark days. Yeah.
What am I doing with this? I just clutch onto my 2008 towel and I go, oh, remember that parade? That was awesome. It's just
they'll be back
further and further away.
They'll be back
eventually.
Yeah.
All right. I don't want to.
You just got to get rid of Ryan Howard.
Dude. Oh my God. The $25 million anchor. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's fine. Woo, right?
That guy.
Sure.
Yes, it'll be more than fine. Well, Darren Ruff up. Come on, man. Let's get on with this.
Yeah.
Jeez. All right. Moving on. Going baseball just seems natural to go right into productive outs. That's the whole reason that I'm talking to you. I don't remember how I found that podcast, but I think somebody basically told me, did you know that the dude from Thrice talks about metal and baseball? And I was like, that sounds pretty good all the way around.
And, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I tracked down Ian and got him on the show. He's a fantastic guest, and that's how I got to you. So what's going on with the Productive Outs podcast?
Right now we're kind of on a break. Thrice did a tour in June. And then Kellen Walled City just did a European run. They were out for like 3 weeks to a month. We were in Europe at the same time. And then Ian just got home, but I'm leaving in a week.
Okay.
To leave again for 3 weeks. So, I mean, we've got stuff to talk about, but we just don't have time to talk about it.
Fair enough.
So, once I'm back from this run, I think it'll be right around the time that the playoffs start. And Ian should be home, and we should both be working on a Less Art record, which is a side project we have together.
Oh, we're going to get there.
I'm sure we'll make time for like a playoff or World Series podcast, but
sure.
Yeah, it's just tough. I mean, it was way easier when I didn't have a kid and Bryce was not doing anything, which is kind of the window where we started that podcast. So
everything
now we're both busy.
So can I ask you a personal question?
Yes.
I'm not going to get too gritty. Don't freak out.
Okay.
What does a guy do for a living? If Thrice kind of went on a, let's say, hiatus, you guys never broke up, but you guys were kind of like a, let's go have kids and stuff. If you guys went on a hiatus and you didn't have kids till now, what does someone do for a living that they can then reboot Thrice and take off for 3 weeks at a time? Like, how are you making ends meet?
Thankfully, Thrice is operating at a level where I can kind of do that and only that now.
Okay, good.
But now we're going to get back from this this fall tour, and we don't really have anything scheduled until maybe February.
Okay.
So that's 4 or 5 months without work, and I'm trying to figure out things that I can do on the side. But during the hiatus, I was all over the place. It was dark days. Okay. You know, I worked a sales job for like a high-end suit company.
Did you really?
Like a tailored suit menswear company. And I was like in a 3-piece suit and tie.
How'd you do?
Five to 6 days a week. Fuck no. I did sell a suit to Mike Trout.
Oh, no way.
Which was my crowning achievement. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I had some connections with the Angels and then got an in. So I went to spring training. I think it was might have been 2014. Okay. And, you know, you set up your deal and, you know, there are like clothing vendors and shoe vendors and bat vendors and all these guys. And I'm standing there like a dickhead in a 3-piece suit. And we had people come up and say, what are you guys all about? Like, what do you do? And I have a little baseball history, so I would chat with them about baseball. And then they liked what they saw. And then I sold a suit to Mike Trout, Kevin Jepsen, Sean Burnett, and then Raul Ibanez when he was with the Angels for like 45 minutes. He was interested but did not buy. But I am not a salesman by any stretch of the imagination. So I was acting in a play or in a movie. Like, this is not me, but this is what I have to do to get through the 9 to 5 or the 9 to 6 or 7 or whatever.
I understand.
So I just did it. And I did it for a year, and the whole time I was like, this is not what I am cut out to do, but I need to do this because I need to make some money. And I did it, and it entailed wearing a suit every day. It entailed having weird, stuffy conversations with lawyers and commercial real estate brokers and guys who could buy and sell me 50 times in a day. And also spend $8,000 on clothes in an afternoon, which is just mind blowing to me. So it was such a weird disparity. Like, I was operating in this world that was so high end and so luxury, and that's so not what I'm into. Okay. But it was an opportunity, and I tried it out, and I gave it the college try for a year, and then I was just like, I cannot do this anymore. It was like, it was messing me up on multiple levels. It was like taking away my creativity. It was damaging my relationship with my wife, with my friends, with my family. Like, I was just in a really bad place. So I had to get out of there. So I did drum teching for Jimmy Eat World. I actually did that ahead of the suit job and then quit the Jimmy Eat World gig to do the suit thing, which was a terrible mistake. Did the suit job for a year, hated it, quit. Picked up a job teching, doing drum and bass tech for Weezer.
Oh, cool.
And was doing that kind of sporadically because they don't really tour like a full-time band. I worked for an athletic apparel company for, I guess, like 6 or 8 months. So okay. I was just like jumping all over the place, trying to figure out where I was going to go because I didn't know if or when Thrice was going to come back. But just trying to find something that worked and something that paid the bills. And thankfully, Thrice came back.
Were you going through like, I don't know what the conversation was when Thrice hung it on a nail for a little while, but was it kind of like, I got to go find something to do until Thrice comes back? Thrice is coming back? Or was it like, oh shit, what if Thrice doesn't come back?
It was more the latter. It was more really? Oh shit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know. I mean, Dustin had a pretty good situation up in the Pacific Northwest, and I didn't know how long he was going to do that or if it was going to end up being something where he was like, this is great. Like, I don't need to ever make music with those guys again, even though he said he wanted to. I mean, when you change your scenery and change what you're doing, if you're satiated on like a creative level and a financial level, then, you know,
why go back?
Really no reason to leave.
Sure.
Yeah. I was trying to find something that I felt okay with that seemed like it had a bit of potential that would also help me provide for my family.
Right.
And the teching stuff was cool, but it was also me traveling and not being creative or not playing music. And then my wife would be like, well, if you're going to be away from home a bunch, I want you to be doing what you're good at and what you've been doing for the last 18 years or 16 years or whatever it was. So yeah, that I had to find something stable at home, and I didn't find much. It's hard when you have an English degree and the past 15 to 16 years of your resume is like, I played drums in a band and helped management out and did some social media stuff and copy edited some press releases and stuff. It's like,
sure,
you sit down in a big time job interview and people are like, oh, that's not legit at all.
Do you have a 4-year degree in English or a master's?
4-year.
Enough to teach?
Yeah. I could get my teaching credential if I wanted to.
You ever think about teaching?
I do. I can barely handle my own kid. How am I going to handle 35 kids? No, I mean, I've thought about it. I coached baseball for a year before Thrice started. Mm-hmm. And it was around the time that I was getting my English degree, and I was like, oh, you know, I could be like an English teacher and a baseball coach. But that would also be settling for something that's not exactly what I want to do.
I got you.
So I don't know. I'm not good at settling. I'm also not good at making life-changing decisions.
I respect that.
Quickly.
I bet there's a lot of Thrice fans listening that are happy that you decided to tread water and wait, because it seems to have paid off. The new album seems to be doing well. Tour is going okay.
It's been really cool, getting
good reception. So tell us a little bit about like getting back together. The hiatus wasn't forever, but I bet it felt completely different because of you know, members moving away and not being nearby anymore. I think there was a lot more correspondence, if I'm reading Wikipedia right, that is. And now you're also coming into it with a child. How's Thrice 2.0 as compared to the first dozen years or so?
I think it's about as good as it could possibly be.
Okay. Fair answer.
We made an agreement when we started talking about getting things up and running again. Like, let's try not to tour for more than 3 to 4 weeks at a time,
mm-hmm.
so that guys don't get burnt out. Let's make sure we have a little bit of a buffer between tours so that guys can come home and be with their families and get back into that. And I never understood that before I had a kid, but like, you're on tour for 3 or 4 weeks and then you come home and it's just like, here's a baby. And then you're like, whoa, oh my God. Yeah, I'm a dad. Oh, I got to handle this stuff. So to be home long enough to jump back into dad mode is really nice. And it doesn't make the impending tour like this big doom and gloom thing, like, oh my God, I got to be away again. It's like, I got my time with my family.
Right.
Now I'm going to go work and provide and then come back and jump back into dad mode. But so we're trying to tour a little bit less. We're trying to be a little bit more reasonable with our practice schedules, stuff like that. We would do stupid stuff like practice 9 to 5 before a tour. And it's like, we're all good enough at our instruments. Like, right. You can do your work on the side.
Sure.
And then when we all get together, the four of us, like, have your stuff together. We'll run through the set a few times and we should be good. And if we're not good, then
we shouldn't go out.
Homework. Yes, we should not be touring.
Right. That's what kids' nap times are for, man. You can go over some notes, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So everything's a lot more manageable. I think the break gave a lot of people more perspective on how lucky we are to be able to do this, even though it does take us away from our families and friends. So everybody's head's in a better spot. People are more enthusiastic, energetic about doing anything and everything band-related. And I feel like towards the end of Thrice 1.0, there was a lot of like, ugh, like, we're doing this again. Oh, we're doing this again. And yeah, I didn't agree with a lot of that, but I do understand how you can get caught up into that mindset where it's just like, you write a record and then you record a record and then you tour and then you come home and you write a record. And it's just like, it keeps spinning and spinning and spinning, and it kind of eats up all the other cool stuff that you could possibly have going on in your life. So now there's like a balance between band, family, outside stuff. Tepe's got a company that makes wallets and bags and really nice stuff, like really, really cool stuff. And he worked his ass off to build this business, and he still wants to be able to do that. And he has time to do both. It's called Teranishi. I don't know where he came up with that name. His last name. Everybody's in a good spot. I think like morale is high and the tours have been going great. Fan response has been great.
That's what I'm hearing. Yeah. Do you think that's what drove the first hiatus, was just, we love this so much, but oh my God, I got to walk away for a while? Or did one person say, look guys, if we have any chance of salvaging this thing, I got to go start a wallet company. Get the hell away from me for 4 years or something.
No. I mean, we were in a pretty good spot, but it almost felt like we had plateaued at like a certain level of success, maybe.
Okay.
And then also like the amount of, I don't know how to say this, like the enthusiasm just wasn't what it was when we were younger.
Got it.
But that enthusiasm has returned now, which is why it's awesome. It's just like, dudes are hungry. They want to make music. They want to push boundaries. They want to make the live show as good as it can possibly be.
Great.
Cool. It's just a much healthier environment all the way around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Towards the end, it was just like, I mean, Tepe and Dustin, they have each of them have 3 kids.
Wow.
So they were dealing with having 3 kids, having to be away from home like 6 to 8 months out of the year. And it was a lot to ask.
Yeah, and it sure is.
Now that I'm on that end of the spectrum, I totally get it. Like being away from my kid is brutal, but if it's a means to an end, like if I can go on tour and provide for my family, then I'm totally for it. And I'm super lucky to be able to do what I do, but it's definitely more difficult than it was in the past, like when I was single or just married, like go on tour and it's fun.
This is what I do.
You don't miss anyone, you know?
Right.
So.
I could understand that.
Yeah.
Do you think are there any surprises this time around? I don't know how else to word that, but last time you got into the typical, I hate to throw this around loosely, but you got into the typical successful band cycle where it's write a record, record a record, play out, write a record, record, blah, 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 blah. It almost became mechanical and, you know, hopefully, well, that tour went pretty good. This one, what's your biggest surprises this time around? Just like what's kind of taking you all back?
I think the shorter touring lengths, like, we just did a 3 or 3.5 week run in the US in June. And towards the end of it, guys were like, man, can you imagine doing this times two? Which is what we would normally do. We'd normally do 6 or 7 weeks. Like, guys are getting tired. You know, wives are texting like, oh, I'm exhausted. The kids are driving me nuts. And we're like, oh, well, we're coming home. So it's going to be great. So I think the shortening the tour lengths has been super helpful.
Okay.
I just think we're communicating better too. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, there were gaps in communication towards like the, I guess from like 2006 to 2010. And now stuff's just much more free flowing, whether it's in like a business sense where you're talking about like a merch design or like when we're going to practice or something, mm-hmm. or when we're discussing parts that we're working on for a song, like everything is much more free flowing. People are speaking with more tact, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's just easier. And I think part of that is just maturity. Like, you get older and you realize that it's not important to obsess over minutia or, you know,
sure.
the BS. Like, let's just get down to brass tacks and do what we need to do and take care of business, do your homework, and have fun doing this. It's an incredible opportunity. So why screw it up by being weird about unimportant stuff?
Is the word efficiency that we're all searching for? You just want to make it like
get your bang
for buck and go home.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's not like we just don't give a shit, you know. But it's
well, and I didn't mean it that way. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But like, I want to make sure nobody else takes it that way.
No. You heard it here. Riley doesn't give a shit. No.
No.
I just meant like instead of before, you might have been able to afford to spin your tires in the mud a little bit because you did practice 3 times a week or you were around each other all the time anyway, whereas now it's kind of like, shit, I get off the pot. Let's accomplish what we set out to do so that, you know.
Yeah. But it's like any, I mean, I don't know. When you're young and responsibility is not like a huge part of your life, I feel like, well, I don't need to practice at home before practice. Like, I'll just practice a band rehearsal or something. And right. now it's like, there's a heightened sense of responsibility. And it's like, take care of your stuff at home. And then when we come to work, like, let's do this. And like a big thing was when I was teching and being around Jimmy Eat World, who's an incredible band, and Weezer, who's been a band for 20 years, these dudes operate at a different, when practice time happens, practice happens and everybody's got their stuff together. There's a level of efficiency that I feel like we didn't ever reach previously.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Because I think there's
also inefficiency depending on which band you're talking about. But
all right, fair enough. But I think there's people probably listening looking up to Thrice as the band that probably did have their act together because you guys are Thrice. That's not an ass kiss statement. That's just pick a tour, pick a festival. You guys were part of it. You guys were getting around. And I bet there's people listening that were like, really? Thrice didn't even think. I guess you're always looking up to the next level. I mean, I'm sure there's a band under Thrice that looks up to what you guys were doing. And then you get a chance to see under Jimmy Eat World's hood and you're like, holy shit, we were nowhere near them. Yeah. You know? And then I'm sure Jimmy Eat World looks up to somebody huge and they're like, we'll never be that good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we had a certain level of efficiency, but I feel like now it's like there's a conscious effort, like, how can we make this better?
Right.
Where before, I think we got kind of mired in, like, this is just how we do stuff, so we're just doing it this way. But there's an effort on everyone's part, like, how can we make this better? How can we make this more enjoyable? How can we make this more productive on all levels?
Mm-hmm.
And we're definitely seeing the fruits of those efforts because this is really awesome. Like, I can't complain about any aspect of it. It's really, really great.
What from the Thrice 2.0 thing? I'm sure that's annoying and that's not how you want to look at it. But from the new go around versus the old go around or whatever you want to call it, what is there anything that you're kind of surprised is aging so well, or have you guys pulled anything out and dusted off an old chestnut where you're like, we never did this before, or it's going over really well, or wow, that flopped like shit, we shouldn't do that anymore? Like, how is transitioning the older stuff into the new Thrice? These are huge questions. I know. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. It's been it's been pretty seamless, I think, for the most part. Like, most of the old stuff is going over well. The new stuff is going over better than I think we could have hoped for or expected. Mm-hmm.
What in particular? Like, what songs are just killing it?
Black Honey.
Yeah.
There's like a vocal break with Dustin and just his guitar.
This time, I'll get it right. It's gonna be this time, I'll get it right. I'll let it be this.
The sing-alongs during that are louder than almost any song we've ever had.
Love it.
Throughout our entire discography. The end of The Long Defeat, the sing-alongs there, like, I've got my in-ears in, and I don't have any crowd mics or anything, but I can hear them over my playing. Oh, like, it's pretty intense. Yeah, the new stuff is going over really well, and most of the old stuff seems like it's holding up. We're dusting off a couple of old songs for this next US run. And then one song from To Be Everywhere Is To Be Nowhere that we haven't played live yet.
Okay.
So we'll see how those go. But for us,
am I allowed to pry and ask what they are?
Yeah.
You can say no.
What do we do? No. This one, I mean, we played The Weight a bunch, but we haven't played it since we got back together. So we're bringing that one back out. We're dusting off Hoods on Peregrine from Artist in the Ambulance.
Oh my God.
Which
I knew this sounded familiar. I haven't listened to Artist for like,
yeah,
God almighty, so a decade, I bet.
That one's like a band favorite, and it never seems to go over well live, because it's like, there are sections that are in five and sections that are in six and sections that are in four.
And screw them.
It's a hard song to like bob your head to, but it's a cool song.
Right.
We all really like it, but it always seemed to fall flat. And then for this tour, we're just like, screw it. We're just going to play it. We like it. It's going to be fun. We are going to be debuting The Window from the new record.
Nice.
It's kind of like a super heavy baritone guitar Radiohead song, kind of.
Okay.
What's the other one? Oh, and we're uncovering Deadbolt, because we put Deadbolt under mothballs for the last couple tours.
Okay.
So we're playing that so that people stop asking us to play it. Between every song.
That was going to be my next question. When the hell are you guys going to play that? I'm totally kidding. Yeah. Jump ahead and go back to something. I, also being a drummer, remember I was subscribed to one Modern Drummer magazine for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually had they actually used to stack papers together in what was called a magazine and mail it to your house.
Never heard of it.
I'm very old, Riley, but yes. I remember reading an article about you, and I don't remember what album it was. So you're going to have to help me out with this.
Okay.
But I remember reading a super interesting article about you. I didn't want to keep all these magazines laying around, but I actually took the time to rip your article out and like throw it in a file of like, I'm going to read this later. Cause that's how you used to like, now you can like save for offline. But I used to actually rip articles out and shove them in a folder, you know?
Nice.
You recorded an album and you guys were doing all kinds of funky stuff. Like I think you actually used your kick drum pedal on like a 5-gallon water jug.
Yeah.
To get some sort of like a deeper kind of a boing noise. And then on that same album, you took all your cymbals off, wrapped your cymbal stands with tape and towels and just played the percussion and then went back and did the cymbals in another track.
Yeah.
And dude, I swear to God, I read that 15 years ago and I never forgot it. Wow. And now I have a podcast and I get to ask you about it. Yes. What the hell were you? Tell me a little bit about that kind of angular, I'm not just going to go in and play my karaoke 4-piece drum kit like everybody else does. Like, was that the producer's idea or did you go in like, dude, this is, I want to try this?
It was a little combination. So that was for Visu.
Okay. That probably makes sense because that was like a gigantic album.
Yeah. Okay. So we worked with Steve Osborne, who's a British producer. And his resume before he worked with us was like Massive Attack, U2, Katie Tunstall. Like,
who was the second one? U2.
Yeah. So he was like a British guy who had worked in a completely different realm than we were coming from.
I would say so.
And it was not the label's first choice, but we wanted to do something different. We really liked our meeting with him. And he pushed us to do a lot of different stuff, like the water bottle thing. It was for Red Sky.
Okay.
He would just have me play loops. And he's like, I had never done that before. He's like, just play a beat, play a bunch of different ideas. I'm going to loop this piano idea or Rhodes idea and just play for minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes and like try whatever you want to try. And then he would chop that up and turn that into a loop based beat, which is how we came up with the verse beat for that song.
And
that was, let's see what a water bottle sounds like a sparklets jug. Okay. Right. And there was stuff with me like tapping on the floor with sticks and hitting wood blocks and doing all kinds of stuff. And it was just, let's gather all these sounds and then piece them together to build a solid beat for the verse of these songs. Then the cymbal thing was something that I had read about, I think, in Modern Drummer before we went into the studio for Visu, and it was Dave Grohl.
Can I jump in real quick?
Yes.
Is that because you just wanted to compress the shit out of the drums?
I think
was part a recording of it. Technique thing.
Yes. Yeah. So I think I read something in Modern Drummer about Dave Grohl recording that Queens of the Stone Age record, Songs for the Deaf, and doing the split cymbals and drums thing. So he had no cymbals, track the drums, because it eliminates cymbal bleed.
Oh, okay.
So you can do whatever you want to the toms, the snare, and the kick. You don't have to worry about any cymbal bleed. And then you go back and you lay the cymbals over it, which is a total mind-bending experience as a player because it's weird to not have your cymbals to lean on. And it's also really weird to not play your kit and then play the cymbals for the song. It took a long time, but
do you actually just rest and not hit any of the drums and just hit the cymbals where they're necessary? Or do you like air drum where you would be hitting toms?
You kind of air drum.
That's bonkers.
It's mental. Like it took me a while to get it done, but Steve was open to the idea and liked the way that stuff was sounding or that he thought it could sound once he started like mixing and messing with stuff. So there are a few songs on that record that I played like that. That record was super fun to make. Like Steve was all for being experimental and pushing us to do stuff that we hadn't done in the past. And we were all just wide-eyed, like, let's just do whatever. Like, let's try all these different things. And we had met with other producers where we're like, oh, we want to try this and try this and this recording technique and this recording technique. And they're like, oh, no, you're not going to do that. Not with me. Not with my major label Chop Shop recording process that I have here.
I have a reputation to keep.
Yeah. Yeah. So Steve was totally open to that, and it was such a cool experience. He taught us so much about stuff. Taught me a lot about dynamics, because I was kind of a tapper when I started playing, and then we worked with Brian McTernan for the first two full lengths, I guess, Illusion of Safety and Artist in the Ambulance.
Okay.
And McTernan's thing was like, dude, you hit like a wuss. You got to lay into your drums. Like, you got to hit harder. So I was all about just bashing, bashing, bashing. And then I worked with Steve, and Steve was like, if you're playing at like a 10 right now, you need to play at a 4. Wanted the drums to sing a little bit more, and
yes,
felt like I was choking stuff. And
so is 4 where you were, and the guy told you to hit harder? Like, were you hitting right around where Steve wanted you to?
I was probably about a 4, a very inconsistent 4 before we worked with McTernan. And okay. Then he was like, you got to go to 10. And then we worked with Steve Osborne, and he's like, you got to go back to a 4. And now I feel like I can do 10 if I need to. I can do 4 if I need to. I can do 6 if I need to.
You guys are one of those bands too. Now we're back on Thrice. We didn't mean to do that, but you guys are one of those bands too. You kind of wash up and down the dynamic thing. I mean, just look at the different albums you guys have put out, and that's kind of part of it. You guys aren't brick walled and just the whole time. You know, it's more of a more of a ride up and down. I like that. That's good.
Yeah, Steve taught me a lot about dynamics, and then also about simplicity too.
Right.
I think when you're young and you're trying to learn all these chops and all these fills, your first inclination is like, how do I shove as many notes as possible into this part? Like fill, 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 fill. Or like at the end of every bar, I do this fill. I do this fill. I do a variation of this fill. Like, let me just put more notes in here. And Steve was like, just play the same beat for the whole song. And I was like, oh, that's not cool. But then I was like, actually, it is cool. Like, if you develop pocket and you develop feel, you don't have to go batshit and do round the clock fills on everything or do quads on every single fill. Like, you don't have to do a double bass run under every fill. Like, just serve the song first.
The Modern Drummer Festival, which I went to many, many, many years.
Chad Smith of the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
He got up there. And he went out with the dude from Deep Purple. He went out with Ian Pace, whatever his name is. Uh-huh. And they like doubled up and just had fun on stage. And he said, here is the absolute number one drum beat. He almost did one of these. Like, look to the left, look to the right.
Yeah.
Face like 1,100 people. He's like, you wanna see the chops that'll get you hired? I'll give you the chops right now, right? Dude, eighth notes on the hi-hat.
Yep.
And just played and played and played. And for a while, we were like, okay, we get it. And then he just kept going and kept going. And then we were like, okay, oh, okay. And then he started he like earned the slow clap because it was like just groove. I mean, it's the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The dude's in the pocket every song.
Yeah.
Nothing on there is award winning or, oh my God, he blew my mind. But you've heard 30 Chili Peppers songs, right?
Yeah.
It's all over. You know? So, I mean, there's a valid point there.
Yeah. I'm all for, like, I will still watch YouTube videos where dudes are just note salad, like, just shoving notes into every possible part. Yeah. And I'm just like, damn, like, that's sick. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish I could play that. But at the same time, I'll watch somebody just lay down a simple 4/4 groove that has like a disgusting pocket. And that is just like, ooh.
Yep.
It's not twisting your brain up. It's just putting your brain into the happiest, most pockety place. And I don't have a ton of chops.
You can watch Thomas Lang videos and just like have your mind completely shredded and fall out of the side of your head. But then I'm also glad I don't have to go downstairs and practice that hard too.
Because that
dude probably just rolls on his snare for like 11 hours a day before he gets started. Dude, I ain't got time.
Yeah. Or, I mean, you could watch like Tony Royster, who's a total shredder, and monster. See him play all this crazy stuff, and he could go full note salad.
Yep.
But then when he lays down just the simplest groove,
yep,
the pocket is so tasty and yep. so deep that you're just like, this is exactly what drums are supposed to sound like.
Exactly. Like, those guys
he has the ability
those gospel, to do those more. Gospel chops guys who have like the craziest, most amazing. They do the acrobats and they come around and land on the one.
Yeah.
And then you look at their resume and they play for pop artist,
mm-hmm.
pop artist. It's just four on the floor, yeah. four on the floor. That's the gig. And
yeah.
I mean, if you want to watch them just do the masturbatory look how good I am stuff, it's on YouTube. But I mean, sure. the paying gig, you're going to go out and play drums with Rihanna, you better chill because her songs don't need.
Totally. And I'll watch them all do all the crazy stuff. And then when they settle back into that just straight four, it's
murder.
The thing that's just like, oof.
Yep.
You feel Game that Chester. In your soul. Yeah.
Your cockles.
You do.
I love it. I'm glad we covered that, man. I'm really glad we talked about that.
Yeah.
You want to take just a side rail for a few minutes and explain what the hell Puig Destroyer is?
Okay.
Other than awesome, because it's amazing.
Yeah. I'm glad you like it. So Puig Destroyer. So,
I'm too busy laughing at it to figure out if I love it or not, but it's so good.
It's completely absurd. So Puig Destroyer is a byproduct of Productive Outs. So Ian Miller, who you had on the podcast episodes ago, we started that baseball-centric Twitter feed, Tumblr blog, podcast. And it was right around the time that Puig got called up and he was like lighting the world on fire. He had, I don't know, he's batting something like 400 and just hitting bombs and driving in runs and making crazy.
Haciel Puig, he's talking
yes.
about.
Yes. Crazy plays and throwing guys out.
And then doing like while he wasn't in the game, doing like, crazy like shenanigans too, like he was like fights with people and everything. He was
just baseball player unhinged on all levels, like on the field, off the field. Ian and I were talking about that on the podcast and we're like, oh man, somebody should make a band, like a grindcore band that only sings about baseball called Puig Destroyer, because we love Pig Destroyer.
It's totally a joke. I love it.
Yeah, we love Pig Destroyer, and Pig Destroyer is basically the metal or grindcore version of Yasiel Puig, like completely unhinged, like gonna fly off the rails at any time, but so fucking awesome.
Right.
So we're like, yeah, somebody should do that. So we end the podcast and like Ian's editing it and I'm like writing up the show notes, and then I get an email and Ian's like, we should start that band.
We're starting.
I was like, yeah, we should. So he started sending me like just rough bass ideas at like 220 BPM. I started programming drums, and we crapped out a 6-song EP in like a week and put it out on Bandcamp, and people started freaking out about it. And like, oh, my baby's crying. Like Yahoo Sports picked it up, Deadspin picked it up. Like it started,
so funny.
We didn't have a publicist or anything. We just put this thing out there. And, you know, I've been in bands where you hire a publicist to get you a look at all these like big media outlets.
Right.
And then meanwhile, Puig Destroyer does zero promotion and it just exploded to the point where, yeah, like 2 weeks after we put out that EP, Puig was listening to it in the MLB fan cave. Somebody played it for him. And he was like, oh, this is very nice. I'm sure he didn't like it, but
I'm sure, yeah, whatever.
But so, yeah, so it's a project with Ian Miller from Kowloon Walled City, John Howell from Kowloon Walled City, Mike Minnick, who was in a band called Curl Up and Die.
Yep.
And it's all done virtually. Like we've never been in the same room at the same time until we started playing Less Art shows, which is another project that was born from this whole disaster.
We're getting there.
So yeah, we were never in the same room. We would just trade files back and forth. I'd program stuff, send it to Ian. He'd lay down bass tracks. John would lay down guitar stuff. Mike would do vocals, and then we'd send it to Scott Evans from Kowloon Walled City, and he'd mix it, and then we'd throw it up on Bandcamp, and done deal. Zero Mike, effort, zero pressure.
Mike's fun. A baseball fan, or are you writing lyrics for him, and he's like, what the hell am I singing about?
No. Mike's a huge baseball fan. He's
okay, so he knows what he. Okay, good. Good, good.
Yeah, he's a Giants fan. Yeah.
Oh, gross. I love the I love the backhandedness of the fact that it's called Puig Destroyer, and my favorite song is about Mike Trout.
Yeah,
it's kind of hilarious, actually. But
yeah, we kind of spitballed like song ideas, but once it came to writing lyrics, it was like Mike would just go wild and then send us his ideas and. So that we could vet them, but we were like, these are great. Just do it. So it's total, total first idea, best idea. Don't overthink anything. There's no pressure. We're just making stupid music about a dumb sport. And
that's just that. Game. Easily transitioning ourselves into Less Art.
Yes.
Super interested about this band. You just played out live, I think, twice or four times. I actually lost track of that.
Twice so far.
But Less Art has only played out twice.
Yeah.
Is there anything out yet? What the hell are you guys doing? Tell us about Less Art.
We have 10 songs written, six of which we have played live.
Okay.
We played a show at the Hemlock in San Francisco, and then the next day we played a show in Orange County at the Constellation Room, opening up for Hey Mercedes. Weird fit sonically, but Hey Mercedes guitar player, Mike Shoemaker, is thrice as front of house guy.
Oh, and no then, kidding.
Yes. And then no way, Damon. I didn't know that. Yeah, Damon Atkinson, who's the drummer for Braid and Hey Mercedes. He was my drum tech for like a year, and then he became our tour manager for like 4 or 5 years. So I'm really good friends with those guys.
I just talked to Damon after the Hey Mercedes show in Philadelphia, and he said he was gonna come on the show.
Oh, cool. Yeah, you got to get him
on. I didn't know any of that. That's killer.
It's a great conversation. Yeah, so I've known those guys for the better part of a decade, and I saw they were playing in Orange County, and Less Art was trying to play out, and I was like, dudes, I know it's not a good fit, and it's kind of a big ask of us, but would you be cool if we opened for you? And they were like, yeah.
And let me guess, they were like, yep.
Yeah. So
I love those guys.
Yeah, we did that. Which was so much fun and so different because, like, I've never played with a band that wasn't thrice, aside from, like, my crappy high school band.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it was cool. You know, the Hemlock show in San Francisco was, like, to 60 people, which is the smallest show I played in years, but it was so, so cool. But I was more nervous for that show than I – have been for almost any thrice show, which was weird. Wow. Yeah. The Hey Mercedes show.
But that's neat. That's neat to throw. I mean, you know, this isn't ass kissy, but I mean, at the level that you're at with thrice and everything, it's, I think that's kind of good for you to throw yourself into that very uncomfortable pair of shoes.
Yeah.
Cause I bet you felt kind of grounded in a way that you haven't in a while. Not that you're walking around head in the clouds, but I mean, like, it's kind of nice to sit there and shit yourself before a show again, right?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. Like, I had, like, nowhere to go. I was, like, warming up in the crowd. And I was just like, oh, my God, man. I got to play. I've never played these songs before. Like, in front of people. So, oh, geez. And then throw your gear up on stage, like, start setting up. And then it's just like, you got to go. Okay, we're playing. And I'm like, playing.
Oh my God. I'm in Less Art.
Yeah. That's like 25 minutes long and it's just pure energy and super heavy and crazy. And Mike's losing his mind singing. And it was so cool. It was so much fun.
What's the future hold for Less Art?
On the schedule now. So we have 10 songs. We're going to record in mid November with Scott Evans from Kowloon Walled City. Up in Oakland, I think we have like a week or 8 days, 9 days in the studio. Record those 10 songs for a full length. Try to do some shows at the end of the year. Try to find somebody who wants to put that record out. And if nobody wants to put it out, we'll probably put it out ourselves. And then just play more shows. I mean, we had so much fun in a weekend just playing two shows. Geography makes it tough because I'm down here in Orange County. Ed's about to move up to the Bay Area. John and Ian are in the Bay Area, and then Mike's in Chicago. So getting everybody together is tough and expensive. But if we can find a way to make it work, we want to put this record out and play and tour a little bit, during breaks between Thrice stuff and Kowloon stuff. But it's so fun. It's just a really cool outlet for all of us.
For those of us that have only heard the 15-second clip on your Facebook page, can you try to explain when you take a podcast about baseball and Puig Destroyer and Thrice and Kowloon and kind of throw it in the crock pot, and like what is Less Art?
It's heavy like Kowloon Walled City. We tune to drop A sharp, which is the Kowloon tuning, so it's heavy as hell. It's a little more up tempo than Kowloon is. Kowloon's like pretty doomy, gloomy, slow. This is bumped up a little bit. I think John Howell's guitar playing in Kowloon Walled City is like one of the things that makes that band for me. It's just so weird and angular and kind of like John Reese Drive Like Jehu weirdness. And then you combine that with my brother's brain, who is not playing bass, but is playing guitar in Less Art.
That's true. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So he's bringing like a bass player, like a very noodly weird bass player's brain to a guitar. And then you're blending those two super weird guitars with like Ian's rock solid bass playing and bass tone. And then me just beating the shit out of my drums and trying to keep it as simple and heavy as possible.
And Ian, like, who said that he started as a bass player and he was never the guitarist that was like, okay, we need a bass player, I'll be bass.
Yeah.
Like, he started as a bassist, and usually everybody has three guitarists and one goes, all right, I'll play bass.
Yeah.
You guys are going backwards where you kind of actually have two bass players.
There's two bass players. Yeah.
The one's playing a guitar. That's, I don't think I've heard anybody say that yet.
Yeah. No, it's super fun. It's like if you threw Fugazi, Drive Like Jehu, Kowloon Walled City, like Jupiter Era Cave-In, some weird Slint stuff.
Slint.
Or Shipping News or something like that, or Farrakhet into a blender. It's just all over the place, but it's super heavy. And then
you're the first person to mention Slint and Farrakhet on the show.
Nice. And then Mike's lyrics are kind of in line with what he was doing with Curl Up and Die, where it's like they're very mortality based and like existential. It's like trying to figure out why are we here? What are we doing here? And how can we make it better? How do we get through this? So I'm stoked. It's going to be cool.
Things and okay. Then we got to close shop for number one, don't go skating past the fact that there's a thing called rileybreck.bandcamp where you have some instrumental things out there. what are you doing? What's that?
Back when I had a lot of free time, which is pre-kid and pre-marriage,
sure,
I would spend most of my waking hours with my face in a computer, just writing and programming stuff.
Okay.
So a lot of that stuff on my Bandcamp is either stuff that I intended to use for Thrice and didn't, or stuff that I intended to use for Thrice and didn't because we went on hiatus, but I liked it and wanted to share it with people. So it's a lot of really like mellow, you know, I like a lot of heavy and aggressive stuff, whether it's the Kowloon Walled City stuff or like Ken Mode or Converge or Dillinger or this or that or whatever. Most of the music I listen to is heavy, but I also have a lot of stuff that I listen to that's more down tempo and mellow and ambient, like Tycho or Alluvium or Hammock. So I'm super into that side, and I don't get to scratch that itch as much as I would like to when I do Thrice stuff.
Okay.
Or Less Art stuff, or Puig Destroyer stuff. So that Bandcamp page was just kind of like a home for all these very drony, hypnotic, melodic ideas that I had. I would like to do more of it, and I have more ideas for it. I just don't have time to do it.
It's more of an idea junk drawer than anything.
Kind of, yeah. And I'm stoked that people liked it. It was really cool. Got a lot of good feedback and had some people use it for like soundtrack stuff. But yeah, it just comes down to managing your free time wisely. So okay. if dadding is number one,
and dadding
dadding is number one, Thrice is number two, Less Art is number three.
Okay.
Trying to not be a fat pile of crap and exercising is number four, then maybe the solo ambient kind of instrumental stuff is number five. So I don't usually get past like number three if I'm lucky. That's life now.
Fair enough. I understand.
Yeah.
I read on the internet somewhere that.
Not true. It's not true.
Okay. Skip it. Scratch that
off. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Is it true that Thrice donates proceeds from each album to a different charitable organization? If that's true, is there one for To Be Everywhere is To Be Nowhere, and what is it?
We did for a long time. We signed with Subcity Records in 2000, I think. And they put out Identity Crisis, Illusion of Safety, and the whole deal with Subcity was like they were a charity-based label, and a certain percentage of the cost of an album would go to a charity of the band's choice. And we loved that because we felt super lucky to be able to do what we did and what we've been doing, and wanted to use some of our good fortune to help people who needed help. So whether it was helping like people from an abused and neglected kind of child home, or a music school for after school program or anything like that. We felt like that was the right thing to do given our situation. We ended up pushing really hard to make Island Records adopt that same idea. So for Artists in the Ambulance and Visu, we kept that charitable donation going, which was a total headache trying to get a major label to understand that they need to give money away. but we ended up making that happen. We worked with a cancer-based charity for a while. And then we worked, VSU, I think, was like a clean water and clean blood organization.
Okay.
But it got so hard to carry this contract structure from label to label, because after VSU we left and went to Vagrant. We didn't think that doing it per record sold was either as successful as it should have been, as easy as it should have been, nor was it the best way to donate to these charities. So we put that into, we'd have an exclusive merch design or something that benefited a charity of our choice, or we'd do a benefit show or more specific efforts than just like buy a record and then 14 gotcha. Cents or whatever goes to a charity gotcha. Of our choice. Like if we were going to do it, we wanted to do it right. So that's something that we're continuing to do. We don't have anything set up for this record specifically, but we will be doing stuff like that in the future. Yeah.
Very cool. That's nice to hear that you, at least it came to the table for a major label. I'm sure they'd give money away. What are you, crazy?
It was tough. It was really tough. negotiating a contract with a major label is difficult in and of itself. Trying to make any changes to those contracts that they have, like in boilerplate form, was like very, very difficult. but gotcha. We got it done. Yeah.
Last question. My small circle of friends here, I actually had a buddy of mine named Brian who said, I would be curious to ask him what it is like for him to play in a band. Now we're back on Thrice, by the way. So okay. Coming back to I'm curious what it's like for him to play in a band where there is such a heavy faith element to the lyrics. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I can. I am all for faith. I don't have a ton of it personally.
Okay.
I was raised a Christian. I was a churchgoer from probably, age 8 to age 16 or 17. My dad was really into the church and very involved in the church. Not as like a pastor or deacon or anything, but just involved in like youth groups and men's groups and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So I'm all for it. And I knew this question was coming and I tried to think about it.
How did you know it was coming?
I listened to the last podcast that you did.
Oh, okay.
Brian Parrish. Yeah. I figured it might come.
Oh no. Am I getting pegged as that guy? That's like,
No.
Let's ask the awkward Christian question.
And it's 100% legit question.
Okay.
I am all for Dustin singing about things that he feels strongly about, whether that's a political issue or a faith issue or like a relationship issue. Okay. If it's coming from a true and honest place, then I back it. For me, I am not a Christian. I'm not really sure where I fall on the faith spectrum.
Okay.
I would like to believe in something greater. I've been through some stuff in my life that made me a doubter.
Mm.
And I feel like instead of using a particular faith as a way to get through that, my brain was telling me to go away from it. You know, I lost my dad. I lost some friends in a car accident when I was super young and got into a situation where I was like, oh, I'm praying for all these things and I see so many terrible things happening. What am I praying for in particular?
Okay. Right.
And I see people that have strong faith and I envy it to a certain extent because there's a level of happiness and comfort that they gain from that I don't have. And I just... Mm-hmm. But okay. I can't make myself get there. I would like to, but I'm not ready to go. Well, this is the one way to figure out how I'm going to deal with this tragedy, or this is how I'm going to wake up in the morning and be like, everything is awesome. Like everything's cool. Or maybe not everything's cool, but everything's going to be okay. Or like God has figured out this plan for me and I'm just going to follow that. And I've seen faith do things to people who I've been close to that I think are unsavory. So it's hard for me to find like a particular path that I want to walk. Not that there needs to be a particular sure. path, but I've seen people say, this is my path and this is how it works. And then I start to think about the way that they're thinking about things or processing things or reacting to things around them. And it just doesn't float with me as like a reasonable way of doing things.
Sure.
So I'm all for faith as long as it doesn't come at the expense of others. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm still searching. I don't know how actively I'm searching, but I think we're all still searching, right?
I
would hope so.
I 100% will be the first one to admit that I don't have any of the friggin' answers, man.
Yeah. I've definitely been around some people who are like, yeah, well, we got it figured out. And it's like,
yeah, they're scared.
Nah, no, that's not the way things work. So
Jason Hammaker from Frotis was on here and he said, he wraps up his faith as the one verse where I guess, man, I'm going to paraphrase and beat the hell out of this verse, but he said
okay.
something about the guy brought his sick son to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, will you heal my son? And Christ was like, do you believe? And the guy's response was like, I believe. but help me with my non-belief, which sounds like a total kind of an answer. But Jason was like, that's kind of where I'm at. And I was like, man, that does kind of hit home. Like it really does. Like I'm with you. We're getting heavy, man. We're getting heavy towards the end here, but I'm with you when you feel like I am praying for something that was diagnosed terminal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. This is,
I did that for 2.5 years and it was most brutal time of my life.
Not for 2.5 years. Mine was 7. It was 7 months from diagnosis to burying the dude. And it was kind of like, why am I going through with this? You know?
Yeah. My dad had the throat and like esophageal cancer. And, he was super, super into faith for a long time. And then I kind of fell out and he fell out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then when he got sick, all of a sudden he picked it back up again. And I was like, okay, why is he doing this? I guess he needs something to lean on, but he's leaning on it super hard.
Which the perspective of one person is, wow, look how strong his faith is. And other people go, well, it's fear. It's crippling to the point where the man doesn't know where else to jump. Totally. Who's wrong?
Who's right? It's like, the atheist like found God on his deathbed or something like that. Like that kind of thing.
Right.
And it was just like, he got so, so heavy back into it towards the end. And I was just like, it's not working. I mean, this disease is stronger than anything, anything. And just watching him go and watching him go the way he did. It's not like God's responsibility to like fix my dad.
Right.
You know, you would hope that you'd get some kind of level of comfort from that. And maybe my dad did. Maybe my dad did get comfort from like seeing a chaplain or something before he died or something like that. But
it's tough because you're laying the entire faith thing up against like you have this stage 4 thing and the only way out of it now is a complete and utter turnaround miracle. And mm-hmm. anything less is a failure.
Yeah.
So that's almost like not fair to the faith.
Oh, totally.
To be like, okay, you didn't fix him, so it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what do I do with it? Is it am I finding comfort or is it just making me question more? Brother, I am right there with you. Wow, mm-hmm. I did not expect this to get this heavy at the end, man.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's amazing. I'm turning over all the rocks and I'm finding human beings the more I talk to them. It's okay.
I don't think I've ever talked about that anywhere.
Wow, dude, that was just a simple question of, hey, man, what's it like to be in a band that has like faith in the lyrics? And look where we went with it. That's what happened.
We got super deep.
Two humans talk, man. That's cool. I appreciate you being that honest too. Let's wrap it up and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I hope things go well with Less Art. I hope to hear an album shortly. I hope things are safe out there on the road with Thrice. What's the baby's name?
Baby's name is Jacob Miles.
Jacob Miles. I hope things all is well with Jacob. You should go tend to him and be with him. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your time.
Oh man. Thank you. I appreciate it. It was really fun.
Thanks, man. Step forward, 2 steps back. Still, I believe there's a
the story grows.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.